In this second hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about a basic human behavior, something that I think probably almost everyone engages in sometime or another, something that we do a lot, and yet something that remains to be maybe, well, in a sense, kind of mysterious. Now, what we're talking about is laughter. Our guest for the program this morning is someone who is recognized as an expert in the field, who has done a lot to legitimate the research into laughter. His name is Robert Provine. He's professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Maryland at Baltimore County. His work has been featured in media around the world, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, other publications. And he's put together a book that reviews some of the various kinds of research that's been done on laughter. And the book is titled Laughter, A Scientific Investigation. It's published by Viking. It is in bookstores now if you'd like to look at it. And, of course, as we talk, your questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in, talk with our guest, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, that's what you get if you match the numbers with the letters on the phone. That's for the local callers, and then toll-free 800-222-WILL. You have questions, you can call in and talk with us. Professor Provine, hello.
Yes, hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure being with you.
So how is it that you decided that this was an area that you wanted to explore?
Well, it was a big career redirection for me. After spending some decades in laboratories trying to study how the brain controls behavior, I wanted to look at human behavior, and laughter was one of the best places to look. I was interested in the brain mechanisms of behavior, and if you're interested in that, you want a mechanism everyone has, and everyone laughs, so laughter is a good place to look. And also, laughter is simple in structure. Everyone laughs pretty much the same way, whether it's a sounds like that. It's a much simpler and more structured sound than the one that we make during speech. Hmm. So it was a fascinating and understudied human behavior, and it's also one that lends itself to rigorous analysis. Also, it was just a lot of fun doing.
And is it also the case that other researchers would say to you, if they were being honest, that they would think that it was not a terribly important thing to be looking at?
Well, actually, most of my colleagues, when I've had a chance to discuss it, have been quite supportive. That on the surface of it, it seems that laughter is a kind of lightweight topic. But when you start to think about it, it's obviously important because we do it all the time. And it's important to know more about it because it plays such an important role in our life. Hmm. So it's pretty easy to win people over to the case of the science of laughter.
Human beings, I think, over time have one of the things that they've been concerned with is their own uniqueness, at least trying to find data that will confirm that. And I suppose one of the things that people have tried to latch on to that separates human beings from other animals is the fact that we do laugh and that we have this playful side to our nature. I guess other animals do play, but are human beings the only creatures that laugh?
No, we're not. We're not the only ones. Other animals make so-called play vocalizations, like rats make a high frequency chirping sound and when they're engaged in rough and tumble play. But when we look at the great apes, they make a sound that's very clearly laughter, and it's very much the same kind of sound that we make. So as we look around the animal kingdom and ask the question, are humans unique because they use tools? Well, the answer seems to be no. Are we unique because we have some sort of language ability, at least at a rudimentary level? It looks like some of the other great apes, dolphins, and perhaps some birds also have some at least modest language ability. But when it gets to laughter, the answer is basically straightforward. The answer is yes, they laugh too. So we're not alone as the laughing animal.
When you think about laughter, I guess one, or I suppose when you think about any kind of behavior, one question one might ask is, what's the What's the function? What's the benefit of that behavior? Or does it have some, when you think about how it is that human beings evolved and why it is we do certain things the way we do, you might ask the question, well, why would we have this particular behavior? What's the function of it? Or did it once perhaps have functions different from that it did now? If you look at it as in the evolutionary sense.
Well, I think whether we look at in the distant past or we look at the present day, the functions are pretty much the same. And the function actually would be a surprise to a lot of people. In fact, virtually everything that I've learned about laughter was a surprise to me. The best way to approach laughter is not ask the question about what's its function and trying to figure out why we do it, because as I learned, laughter is really not consciously controlled. So we're not a good witness to our own behavior. For example, if you ask a person, why did you laugh, that person may be able to give you some sort of explanation, but I don't think you should pay much attention to what it is, because people don't choose to laugh like they would choose a word in speech. It simply happens. So you shouldn't ask a person why they laugh, and likewise, we shouldn't sit in our armchairs trying to scratch our head and figure it out. We've had over 2,500 years since the time that Plato and Aristotle wrote on this topic that has not been very successful in explaining why we laugh. A better approach, the one that I took, was basically to get out of the laboratory and look at laughing people in public places. And there we found that these observations, simply descriptions of what people do, drove us to some very exciting conclusions, and ones that I would have never anticipated at the outset. You know, for example, when you listen to what people say before laughter occurs, they're not telling each other jokes. In fact, I hardly believed this when I first encountered it, because most of the literature about laughter is really about humor, you know, trying to explain why we laugh at jokes. So everyday behavior suggests that laughter is not about jokes. Perhaps only 10%, 15%, a small amount of laughter really follows jokes. So laughter is about something else. And what's it about? It seems to be about people. Laughter is a message that we send to other individuals. The laughter virtually disappears when we're alone. For example, a person sitting alone in a room is going to be laughless. Even when you're looking at a television or reading a book or listening to the radio, these media provide a kind of vicarious, a kind of virtual social stimulation. When you laugh at the television set, you really are laughing at the people inside the television set. When you think about things, you might be laughing at annex of people in your head. But basically, laughter is about relationships with people. So we need to get out and look at where the people are. So if you could ask the question about who do we laugh with friends, family, lovers, other people that we care about. And laughter is a kind of social glue that binds us together.
So it is the case that laughter is contagious. In the sense that if we're with other people and they're laughing, then it would be more likely that we also would laugh.
Yeah, it's very strongly contagious. And it's really about groups. And that's something that, for most of the 2,500-year history of thinking and writing about laughter, people have missed. It's not about jokes. It's about relationships between the people. And also, some other surprises that came is that when you listen about to who speaks and who laughs, we found that the speaker, the person saying something, laughs even more often than the person speaking that's being spoken to, the audience. So here's a scenario very different than that of stand-up comedy, where you have a comedian who doesn't laugh, is typically deadpan, talking to an audience that laughs. This is not really what's going on. So you have both speaker and audience laughing in everyday conversation, with the speaker laughing even more than the person being spoken to. In fact, that was another one of these surprises. You know, that laughter is not about jokes, it's about relationships. and that the speaker's laughing even more than the person being spoken to. When I first started to do this research, I didn't even have a category for what the speaker did. I was just going to pay attention to what caused audiences to laugh. I had to rethink what I was doing. I also had to pay attention to the different behavior of males and females. This was a surprise to me at the beginning, but turned out to be one of the most interesting and one of the strongest findings. For example, both males and females laugh a lot. Yeah, guys get together and, you know, laugh it up, and women will laugh a lot too. But when men and women talk and laugh together, something very strange happens. For example, a guy could be laughing it up with his buddies, and a woman would join the group, and the guy suddenly laughs less, may clam up altogether. But the woman may be laughing up a storm. This is very curious, because it's not that the man decides not to laugh at the woman, or the woman decides, oh, I'm going to really laugh a lot. Because laughter is really not a consciously controlled behavior. So when we laugh at or speak with and laugh with men and women, our behavior is changing in radical ways, but it's unconsciously controlled. We don't choose our laugh pattern. When we laugh, we don't choose, you know, ha ha ha, like we would choose a word in speech. It simply happens in these social situations.
Well,
so by looking at these patterns, we get a kind of uncensored view about interactions between males and females that people really don't realize it's happening.
We have a few callers here to bring into the conversation. We'll get their questions and invite others. And also, I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Robert Provine. He's professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Has done work in this area, has drawn together some of the research that's been done on laughter, and it's in his book, which is titled Laughter, A Scientific Investigation. It's published by Viking. So if you're interested, you can seek it out. And of course, if you have questions, you can call us 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. We have three people here ready to go. We'll start with line number one right here. Hello.
Hi. I just had a question relating to, again, what makes people laugh, but specifically slapstick, which slapstick humor I think has been around for a long time, and typically it involves somebody getting hurt, or at least the appearance of somebody getting hurt, which many people, including myself, although not everyone, my wife hates it, find incredibly funny. And I'm thinking that it's been around for a long time. I mean, I remember the movie The Name of the Rose and the second book of Aristotle. You know, I don't know if that book actually exists, but the implication was that even in the Greeks felt it funny when someone else was in a bad spot. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little about why we find it so humorous when someone else has some misfortune. And, you know, you mentioned that people don't tend to laugh by themselves, but I have certainly laughed when I've seen somebody slip on the ice or fall down, and I've chastised myself for laughing because I think this is horrible. They could have hurt themselves, but at the same time, I couldn't help myself. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Interesting question. What do you think?
Well, a number of important issues come up there. First of all, you mentioned your embarrassment at laughing at someone else's misfortune. Well, first of all, laughter is an unconsciously controlled behavior. The best way of dealing with that is simply ask someone to laugh on command, and they'll usually say, well, I can't laugh just because you asked me to laugh. So when you laugh, it's something that's simply not, it's occurring spontaneously, and it's an instinctive act. So that's one of the reasons why we shouldn't be too analytical. Think as hard as we can about laughter, we're not going to come to the right conclusion about it. But back to laughter's rowdy ancient heritage, one of the reasons that Aristotle and Plato were very much concerned about laughter was its darker side, something that's forgotten in our kind of feel-good, be-happy society, laugh our way to health, ha-ha-ha, and all this kind of business. Plato was actually quite negative about laughter, first of all, because it reflected a darker side of human nature. And also, he believed that not that laughter was superficial, but it was very powerful. In fact, laughter was something to be respected and probably even feared because it would undermine the authority of the state. He even suggested rewriting some of the myths about the ancient Greek heroes and gods because of their raucous nature. Bad role models. You know, Greek gods had lifestyles like rock stars. And then also, he was concerned about the undermining the authority of the state. And so there is this this ancient darker side that we've lost track of. Even during the last year, the news has been filled with evidence of this laughter's darker side. For example, in the Columbine shooting, these two male high school students were wandering through the high school blowing out the brains of some of their high school classmates. They were laughing their way through that, something that's forgotten. During racial and ethnic violence in Indonesia, in Kosovo in the last year or two, there are people being stomped to death in the street amongst a lot of laughter. So laughter does have this powerful, it does have this darker side that would both draw people together who's in the group, you know, help people identify with who they are and who's not a member of this group. You know, for example, laughter is both a way of binding people together in the group as well as driving people out of the group. In fact, we even have a name for that negative kind of laughter. We call it ridicule. And so laughter has very powerful social sanctions. It can both drive people away from our group. It can bind people together in the group. And it's also a way of bringing outliers into the group by ridiculing and laughing at people, not members of the group. It's going to encourage them to conform. Well, while all of this is going on, it's unconsciously controlled. And so when we look at this instinctive behavior of laughter, we're looking at something that's very ancient, that's very deeply ingrained in our nature. And I guess what I've been saying, that the question you ask is a very deep and rich one.
Well, is there an answer to that question, why it is that and maybe everyone's not so vulnerable to slapstick humor, but a lot of people are? You know, why is it when you see the person slip on the proverbial banana peel that some people at least think that that's hysterically funny?
Okay. I dealt with part of that in my response, but I'll try to say a little bit more. First of all, most laughter is not a response to jokes. So when you're looking at things like slapstick humor, you're not looking at the context of most humor. But when you are laughing at someone's misfortune, someone that's different from you, it is an expression of both you're not part of the group to become part of the group, or to drive someone away from the group by doing this. But again, we should be very hesitant about trying to explain what we do because we're dealing with an unconsciously controlled instinctive behavior. So in responding to your question, in part, I'm engaging in a kind of behavior that I've actually been warning against. I think it's better to look at the situations in which we do most of the laughter and describe what we do. Mm-hmm. As opposed to trying to account for why we do it, something that we really don't know.
Well, let me then ask you just one the quick follow-up again, because you've noted a couple of times the fact that laughter is not something that's under conscious control, and it's extremely difficult, this may be impossible, if you just go up to someone and say, now I'm going to count to 10, and when I get to 10, I want you to laugh. People can't do it. However, it does seem to be more the case that if someone is trying to make you laugh, if you're determined not to. That is, it seems to be easier for us to not to laugh than to laugh. Is that the case? And if so, why would that be the case?
Well, that's true. It's easier not to laugh than to laugh. So a good way of thinking about laughter is looking at what's really a kind of complementary behavior of crying. It's difficult to cry on command, too. Experienced actors can do this, but it's difficult to do. In fact, they usually resort to for example, in method acting, trying to think about something that's really sad to get us to cry, or think about something that's very playful or happy to promote laughter. So it's difficult to consciously tap into these deep neurologically programmed ancestral behaviors.
Well, let's talk with some other callers. We'll go to line number four right here. Hello.
Good morning. I am slightly surprised that it's, nobody's mentioned yet Baudelaire's well-known work, The Essence of Laughter, in which he affirms that the essence of laughter is satanic, and there's certainly plenty of evidence for that fact. You've been talking about it. I'd like to close my little remarks with three very short examples of same, but I really think that in the history of human evolution, you point out the connections with the great apes, that this is just basic to the beast disease called man, as Nietzsche. I'm afraid I'm a bit of a name dropper. I remember Charlie Chaplin. I think certain of his one or maybe both of his parents were alcoholic, and in one of his short films, I think it's called The Leisure Class, there's a costume party, and this one fellow who's dying to have a drink is in an armor suit and one of these old-fashioned, old-fangled from the Middle Ages outfits, and he can't open the visor, and it's really especially one of my friends, Chicago friends, said it's a perfect explication of what it's like to be an alcoholic. Three quick specimens of the dark humor. Oh, I'd like to mention this wonderful British movie called The Ruling Class, which starts off with a rather special scene involving a guy in a ballerina suit, and you know you're in for a wild ride thereafter. There's this book I read a while back. It's one of those Joseph Limbaugh cop novels, and there's been an automobile accident. This one cop, who's rather a twisted specimen of the genre, they're rerouting traffic through an alley. And he has an eye for out-of-towners. He knows they're less likely to complain about this or that bit of cop outrageousness. And this woman driving this vehicle asks him, what's happened, officer? And he says to her, I'm afraid there's been an accident, ma'am. And she says, good gracious, anybody hurt? And he pulls up from behind his back what he's been holding, this severed head of this woman by her hair, and says mildly, well, this one did get roughed up a little.
I think that'll probably do it. I think that sort of makes the point. Let me get back to the guest. I don't know. I suppose in a way we've touched on this, why it is that that horrific things sometimes can make us laugh. And really, you know, what is the appeal of that kind of dark humor?
Well, the dark humor, and again, we should be hesitant to engage in explanations. It's better to try to say, you know, what are the proper, you know, what are the instances in which we laugh. And again, to bind us together or to notify other people are not part of this group. And so someone else's misfortune might be an acknowledgement of saying they're not part of our group and so on. A highly entertaining example of one of the darker aspects of humor is the fairly recent French movie called Ridicule, which is an outstanding case. They talk about laughter in the French court and the role wit played in, you know, in stratifying the group.
Well, that.
But in looking at the drawing people together or forcing people out, I think some of the best hints of getting at what the roots of human behavior are is to look at some of our nearest primate ancestors. Again, the great apes, the gorillas, orangutans, and chimpanzees all perform a kind of laughter that sounds quite like our own, And I'll give you an example of it. It's a kind of panning sound. Sounds like a sort of a gruff, panting dog.
Hmm.
If you tickle a chimpanzee, engage in some rough-and-tumble play and make those sounds. So laughter has its roots in these panting, labored breathing of rough-and-tumble play. And we've redirected that panting into a ha-ha-ha sound of human speech. But the ha-ha-has really are symbolic, a kind of ritualization of that labored panting of rough-and-tumble play. And in chimpanzees, before one will tickle the other or engage the rough-and-tumble play, they may pant. And during the rough-and-tumble play, the panting also signifies that this is play. I'm not attacking you, which is something that's, you know, like rough-and-tumble play would be a kind of symbolic fighting. But it's playful without harmful intent. And so that's the roots of where the human laughter comes from. But so we look at rough-and-tumble play and tickle, and we look at things like joking behavior, be it slapstick or response to jokes. We're looking at a kind of modern cognitive behavior, a recently evolved cognitive and linguistic sort of bell and whistle that's been added on this ancient neurological core of laughter. So when we look at jokes and humor, we're looking at something that's modern in our evolutionary history. And to really understand laughter, we need to go back to our primate ancestors. And there we're going to find that rough-and-tumble play and tickle is closer to the roots than joke-telling.
Well, let's talk with some other folks. Let's go to line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wanted to get your opinion on what be another possible satanic laughter. Have you heard the National Public Radio show Car Talk with Tom and Ray Magliazzi?
Oh, yes.
Okay, then I'd value your opinion on why that is so well received, why it's turned out to be, I think, still the most expensive show for National Public Radio.
Yeah, well, the first time I heard Tom and Ray, I was sort of blown away. I was wondering, can these guys be serious? You know, but I was listening both from the point of view of trying to also solve the automotive puzzle they present. But I think one of the most powerful parts of their presentation is, you know, their crazed laughter. So they're providing kind of their own laugh track. Well, they do tell some jokes. They are laughing along with what they're saying. And we do have a powerful tendency to laugh and smile along when we hear other people doing it. So I think they are tapping into this contagious laugh response. But there's a case where it has a positive tone and tends to be very engaging and amusing. But for the most part, they aren't telling jokes.
Are they
an amplified version of what we all experience?
When you were speaking, I was wondering, are they in effect inviting you, at least vicariously, to join them and become part of this family group in which they josh each other, kid each other, laugh at adversity, and sound for an hour at least like a pleasant gang to belong to?
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, what would it be like if you had one or the other of them on by themselves? I think the show wouldn't work.
Because
you would have a person
laughing shows
in isolation. But you have these two netty brothers, and so it provides a context for this to happen. If they were just laughing by themselves in the air, I think it would probably flop, not be funny. It'd simply be bizarre. But that would be an interesting test. Get Tom or Ray on by themselves and see if their shtick works.
Well, thanks for your
advice. Thanks. Well, that I think I should also point out, you know, this may, again, be an illustration of the fact that people have individual reactions to humor. I think that when it comes to Tom and Ray, there are people either who love them or people who hate them. I'm not sure that there's any in between. But it sounds as if you're saying that it's just that for the people who like that show, the reason that they like it is that these guys seem to be having such a good time. Somehow, in listening to them have a good time, then we have a good time.
Yeah, and laughter's a potent thing. It can be both very attracting as well as driving us away. I think that this notion that laughter's frivolous, first of all, doesn't reflect the history of thinking and writing about it. You know, again, going back to Aristotle and Plato. In fact, Plato felt that we needed a national laugh policy. He had even guidelines for laughter for his ideal republic. So clearly, laughter is very powerful and can, again, draw us in the group or drive us away. Hmm. It's certainly not a trivial thing.
Let's talk with someone here online, too. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is, why do you laugh when you are under the influence of drugs or alcohol?
That's a good question. Some agents that will certainly increase laughter would be alcohol, other ones marijuana or hashish. In fact, probably the most riotous laughter is that's promoted by marijuana and hashish. Also laughing gas, something that's used less these days for dental procedures. But asking the question why, first of all, I don't believe that these drugs do something magical to laughter. I don't believe that they super-stimulate some sort of hypothetical laugh center in your brain. And more likely, they simply lower our threshold for laughter. For example, everything starts to be funny. It could be a friend simply coming up and say hello. It could be a friend making a face. It could be anything, and it would just be absolutely riotous. So that sphere of things that would be in that category that we'd call funny, things that would make us laugh, becomes a lot greater. So I don't believe that these drugs and gases are doing something special, but simply make us more prone to those same kind of laugh-promoting stimuli that otherwise fill our lives. Mm.
You talked earlier in the program about about laughter as social glue. Can you learn something, though, also about dominance and hierarchy in groups when you look at who laughs most and what people in social interactions, what people are laughing in response to?
Yeah, well, laughter provides some interesting insights into organizations and interpersonal relationships. First of all, because it's unconsciously controlled, we don't decide to do it. So when you look at laugh patterns, you're getting a kind of uncensored perspective about relationships. If you look at an organization, for example, you find that if you record the kinds of comments the boss makes, there's a wider variety of things that can be used for humor by the boss. Humor is a kind of downward thing. The boss can tell jokes about everything. The most interesting study about this was actually done in a psychiatric hospital, and you found that the head physicians, the psychiatrist in charge, would make jokes about the residents, their colleagues, the patients, paraprofessionals. But when you went down the pecking order in the psychiatric staff meetings, you would find that the paraprofessionals or the residents would only make jokes about people yet lower than them. Patients and residents, for example, don't tell jokes about the boss, but they may laugh up a storm. So everyone laughs. However, the topics of humor are usually people below you in the hierarchy. Now, getting on to interpersonal relationships, this is quite interesting, too, again, because we're getting an uncensored perspective into relationships. Earlier on, I'd mentioned that both males and females laugh a lot, but really interesting things happen when they start to talk to each other, is the man clams up and women start to laugh more. And again, without getting into the issue of trying to account for why they do this, because men and women don't really clearly understand why they're doing this. It simply happens. But women laugh more in the presence of men, and men laugh less in the presence of women. And it's not that women decide to laugh more or women decide to, or men decide to laugh less. They're simply doing this. If you investigate the potential for relationships developing between couples that have various laugh patterns, you learn some very interesting things. For example, if a man and woman are talking together and the woman's laughing up a storm and the guy's just sort of quiet, engaging the conversation, not laughing, this is a very positive predictor of the future of the relationship. Men like women are more, and if you ask them, are you likely to call up this woman for a date, they're more likely to say yes if the woman's laughing a lot in his presence. Also, women like men that make them laugh. So women will often say that they like men with good sense of humor, but they're not requesting men who laugh. In fact, how many women would be strongly attracted to some giggly guys? In fact, that really doesn't compute. I think, well, I don't want this giggly guy. So when women are attracted to men with good sense of humor, they just want men that make them laugh. In fact, this is also reflected in personal ads. I've done an analysis of over 4,000 personal ads. We have the so-called in search of format. And men typically are looking for attractive young women, while women are looking for more psychological things, personality, and one of the strong requested items is sense of humor. But men or women are not requesting men that laugh. They're requesting men that make them laugh. Men don't reciprocate this interest in the sense that they don't ask for women that laugh, but they'll often request or acknowledge that they have good sense of humor. So men are offering what women want, a sense of humor. In other words, they go out of their way to promote laughter in women, and women request men who will make them laugh. So we have this kind of unacknowledged script going on in relationships. So next time you go to a social gathering, a cocktail party, a business meeting, and you look at laugh patterns, you can really get some insights into who likes who, who's the person in charge. Now, there's a lot of these kind of things going on that I developed some of these considerations in the book, and that, again, the intriguing thing is this is uncensored, so you're really finding, getting an insight into what people really think.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left. We have a number of callers. The lines are full. We'll try to get in everyone. And also I'll introduce again our guest, Robert Provine, is professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. If you'd like to read more on the subject, look for his book, Laughter, A Scientific Investigation. It's published by Viking. First caller up in line here is on our line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I do have a couple of things. Maybe I can get to them. I wanted to talk about the chimpanzee panting business, but on the subject you're just talking about, and you just sort of pointed at it, isn't it true that if there's a dominant, subdominant relationship, in other words, you're supposed to laugh at your boss's jokes and not necessarily vice versa?
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's all of the gender business, but...
Well, that may be a reflection on the gender. Again, it's interesting because it's not consciously controlled, so the women's increased tendency to laugh at men may be a reflection of the dominance of the male. And
laugh at men or laugh at men's jokes, let's be clear.
Women's request for humorous men may be a veiled request for more attractive, dominant men.
I wanted to ask you about the chimpanzee. I'm suspicious of chimpanzee analogies to human behavior after all... We've heard this stuff about the bonobo being quite a different kind of cultural form, and maybe they do it too. But what are you basing this assertion that laughing is actually this panting under behavior? I mean, do you have any like neurological support for that, or are you just saying it looks so similar it has to be the same thing?
There's a lot of similarities. In fact, if you were playing with a chimpanzee and tickled it, I think you wouldn't be asking this question because it's so obvious. In fact, it's so obvious some of the number of investigators have actually overlooked some very important differences. For example, Darwin has talked about laughter in chimpanzees and, you know, very directly drew a comparison. You know, if you engage in rough and tumble play or tickle a chimpanzee, it makes this In fact, that panning sound has about twice the rate of a ha-ha-ha. And the thesis I develop in the book was basically the panting, the becomes ha-ha-ha in humans. We just make the sound during an outward breath instead of having the panting.
Again, though, I mean, you're just taking that from, it looks similar, you're not, I mean, I don't know whether it would actually be proving anything if you had the neurological evidence to show that similar sorts of neurological pathways were invoked, but I'm just wondering. I guess maybe it is experiential.
Homologies, the similarities in the behavior, are actually quite striking. As you get the panting chimpanzee laughter during rough and tumble play, you get it during tickle. The chimpanzee makes a distinctive play face, and we have a play face during our own tickle and rough and tumble play encounters. And also the vocalization, well, the chimpanzee is an unvoiced panting sound, and human laughter is a voiced exhalation where you have chopped vowel-like sounds.
What about the
because
I can't cry or something like that. This goes into, I guess, maybe this idea that there's a personal or cultural difference in what people find funny.
Well, there are cultural differences in humor. And in the book, I really don't explore those, but because most analyses of humor are dealing with the higher order cognitive and linguistic variables. And there's almost no analyses of the laugh sound itself. So if you're trying to get to the roots of laughter, which I am, what's its neurological basis? What about its development and evolution? I think we need to go back to the chimpanzees. We need to start with the sound and the issue of how the sound's produced. And linguistics is basically something that occurs from the neck up. It involves a certain amount of hand-waving and theorizing. So if you ask the question about what is laughter as a sound, that's a fact. If you ask questions about the social settings of it, that's a fact. I've tried to avoid, you know, the context of a lot of linguistic analyses about things like why we're laughing at jokes. And I do believe, however, the chimpanzee story does provide some very interesting insights. Also, if we look back at early human behavior, we find laughter... first stimulus for human laughter is tickling. And there, I think we, as we look at development unfold, get some hints into the evolutionary sequence.
I don't know. Maybe this is just gratuitous, but I think maybe crude human behavior is, I guess, regarded as juvenile humor. But if you go to toostupidtobepresident.com and look at the respective president and first lady picking their noses at a Rangers game, you kind of wonder about what's funny and what's not and what's just pathetic. I got to go.
Well, all right, let's go to another caller. Here's a good line number one. Hello?
Yeah, hi, this is Scott Burdick. I'm mom at Seymour High School.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, are you more likely to laugh when you're tired, or are you more likely to laugh when you're fully alert, like when you wake up or in the middle of the day?
Actually, I've done a number of studies on circadian patterns and things like yawning that I haven't dealt with laughter so far. I think the best tip-off would be at the time of day where you're around other people.
Okay.
So you're less often around other people when you wake up or going to bed. But since laughter is about relationships,
right,
I'd say find the times when you're around other people, and those are the places that you're going to see laughter.
All right, thank you. Let's go here to line number two. Hello.
Hi. I didn't hear all of the program, so you may have already talked about this, but I wanted to mention that, of course, the point has been made that tears and laughter are closely interwoven, and that some of the best comics are some of the best dramatic actors and so forth. And I wanted to relate a story that when I went to North Carolina years ago for the untimely death of my niece, who at 17 died of a brain tumor after horrible illness and so forth, I went to the service with the family and stayed with them that night and so forth. And I remember we were in the living room surrounded by all of these, you know, it's sort of like a sea of flowers, you know, and we were all sitting on the floor. And I had been struck earlier that afternoon by the caricature kind of performance of the minister, who had sort of long white hair that needed to be cut, and he was really doing this fire and brimstone, you know, super exaggerated, as I say, caricature-like performance. And I had this split second where I was thinking about it, and I tried to figure out whether it would just be the worst thing imaginable to say to these people who were mourning the loss of their child, or whether it'd be the best thing in the world. And as it turned out, I made the remark. I said, you know, this guy was up there. I've never seen a minister like that before. It reminded me something like it reminded me of something straight out of Saturday Night Live. And everyone just burst into laughter, and it was the most therapeutic moment that I can think of in my life in terms of laughter being exactly what was needed at that point in time because there was so much sorrow. And as I say, I thought I might share that with you because I think there is such a close link between laughter and tears of sorrow.
Well, clearly there are, and it's pointed out in the traditional Greek mask of comedy and tragedy that the two do go together. And actually, when I think of recent movies, you know, whether we're looking back to Robin Williams' The Fisher King, which I thought was a very strong dramatic work, or more recently Jim Carrey's Man on the Moon, which I thought was an excellent dramatic piece. You know, clearly it's hard to do comedy, but the two go together. And again, you go back to those companion Greek masks, you find it. In both cases, they're unconsciously controlled. It's hard to convincingly cry or to laugh.
I'm sorry to say, at the point we're going to have to stop because we've just used our time. And for people who would like to explore the topic further and in greater depth than we have here, look for the book that I mentioned. It's titled Laughter, A Scientific Investigation, published by Viking, by our guest Robert Provine. And he is a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Professor Provine, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, it was a pleasure.